because we've seen coup after coup after coup. And as I say, it's sort of been normalised rather than being the exception. So I do think that the Liberals who are trying to say now that last week was just a bit of a bad week and do not feel they have to explain this should be held more to account.
One for Mum, one for Dad, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and here in Canberra, the dust is still settling after more blood was spilt, after two coup attempts, mass resignations, and yet another Prime Minister was taken down before sitting out a full term, in what is surely one of the most dysfunctional displays of politics in recent memory. And let's face it, there's some stiff competition.
Good evening. Malcolm Turnbull is hanging on as Prime Minister tonight.
Nice to be in front of the cameras where I can smile.
Can you rule out having any leadership ambitions?
Me?
Yeah.
This is my leader.
Yeah, good on you. Thanks, Gomo.
Member for Dixon has the scalp of the Prime Minister hanging from his belt.
Australians will be just dumbstruck and so appalled.
We're on your side. That's what matters.
But rather than covering it for the blood sport that these leadership coups have become, the media reflected public sentiment, which is quite simply, we're over it.
As the canvas rolls on, voters are watching on in absolute disgust.
All right, let's get to the question at hand. Why did you have to dump Malcolm Turnbull?
Well, in the end, Deputy Leader.
And why?
Well, because that's what...
That doesn't answer why. Sorry to interrupt you, but why?
What did last week's events actually achieve? Yes, we got a new Prime Minister, but what did it achieve in the national interest?
Is it any wonder that the people of Australia are utterly sick of politics?
It seems to me that it's a very strange and rather politically amoral world when we'll just tell the Australian public we'll move on. We won't be accountable.
So with impeccable timing and only 1 week into Scott Morrison's new prime ministership, the Australia Institute hosted a Politics in the Pub to launch a new book looking at everything that is wrong with politics today. The book is called Knowledge Solution, Politics, subtitled What's Wrong With It and How to Fix It. Longtime political correspondent and professorial fellow at Canberra University, Michelle Grattan, edited this book and wrote the introduction, and she joined the Australia Institute for Politics in the Pub at the ANU. So please excuse the noisy recording. The Australia Institute's Executive Director, Ben O'Quist, is the MC for the night.
I'm going to start by asking Michelle the most obvious question. Michelle, what is wrong with politics and how do we fix it?
Okay, how long did you say this lasted? I think that what is wrong with politics at the heart is that we've got a system now in which people have lost trust. Politicians always talk about listening to the public, but they're not really listening to the public. They're listening in a focus group sense. They're listening when, like the new Prime Minister, they go out with cameras and pose in a drought-stricken area, and they call that listening. But if they were really listening, they would hear the message that people don't trust them anymore, that they don't like their behaviour, that they don't really think that they're there for the good of the public. They think that they're there for their own interests or their own ideology or some self-indulgent reason. And fixing it, I don't think anyone has an answer to fixing it, but one thing is that the politicians don't recognise the problem. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke to a group of people from Melbourne. It was a leadership group. They were sort of middle-level executives, and they were spending the day in Canberra. There are all sorts of people from health sector, various other occupations. And they'd been to question time. And I talked to them in the evening, and they were absolutely disgusted at what they had seen. They'd looked up across in the gallery and they'd seen school kids there, and they were sort of almost ashamed that these school kids were witnessing this question time. And this was before all the leadership kerfuffle. This was I'd sort of been hearing it on the monitor, and it was a fairly standard question time.
Situation normal
in my eyes, and no doubt yours too. But these people who come from out of town, from the real world, from Melbourne, just felt that I'm an old Melburnian, so don't laugh. Just felt that this was completely appalling. And one guy said to me, he either was or had been a primary school teacher, and he said, you wouldn't have kids behaving like this. So I think the fact that the politicians, if we had them here, they'd say, oh, yes, we know people don't like that, but they will not change their behaviour. And that is sort of typical of the fact that they're not realising that they are so much the problem, and that's why people distrust and dislike them.
Michelle, how is that connected to our current... We were talking in the car on the way over here, what you call our coup culture. Is our coup culture that has developed, your term, a result of that disconnection with the public and, in a sense, an exaggeration of that bad behaviour in question time spilling over into bad behaviour internally? And why did that coup culture start?
Well, it's very hard, really, I think, to sort of see causes and effects in some of these things. But you can see it almost as the ultimate professionalisation of politics. You've got not just the politicians, but you've increasingly got a class of staffers who often are much more into politics than policy. And you've got, the rise in more recent times of the 24-hour media cycle, where any backbencher can get a spot on Sky. And I guess almost as part of this, the fact that people have come to regard leadership changes of the Prime Minister in particular over the last decade, as sort of a normal thing to do. Now, I always think we must be very careful not to romanticise the past, because if you read over Australian history from Federation, of course, you'll find periods of people behaving badly, of high drama and insults flying, of leaders being knocked off and all that sort of thing. In the more immediate past, we can all think back, Keating displacing Bob Hawke, for example, you know, a coup. Although that coup seems very civilised, I have to say, by today's standards. But what we've seen in the last decade, I think, does have an element of newness, because we've seen coup after coup after coup. And, as I say, it's sort of been normalised rather than being the exception. Now, you can justify particular coups, you could say, and I think I have said, that the replacement of Gillard by Rudd in 2013 was rational from the Labor Party's point of view because it saved the furniture. Similarly, it was thought that replacing Tony Abbott with Malcolm Turnbull would improve the Liberal vote. So there are rationalisations for some of these individual coups, but when you look at the whole picture, you can see that overall it's quite destructive of the system. And I think another element in parties thinking these days is that losing an election is sort of inconceivable. You can't think, well, yes, we do seem to be headed for a defeat, we'll try and do our best, but sometimes you've just got to take it, to accept that you're going to be defeated. So now you get a sort of desperate attempt these days to avoid defeat. Although I do think that this latest coup actually was less about that and more about, firstly, revenge for what had happened to Tony Abbott, and secondly, about trying to control the soul of the party. And the Conservatives felt that they needed to try and just get a grip on the party's ideology and policy. Now, of course, they didn't quite succeed in that, but that was what they were attempting to do.
This is really interesting to think about whether this coup might be different. I was mentioning earlier to you that John Howard had given a talk on the weekend here in Canberra, and when pressed about it, said, well, look, parties change leaders when they think it's good for them, when they think it improves their prospects. But is this coup different in the sense that it wasn't about that, as you're intimating there? It is more like a right-wing coup. But isn't the reality that all will be wiped away if the government wins the next election? This coup will be seen as a masterstroke. If they lose the election, the coup will be seen to be a disaster. And really, none of this will matter. All that matters is winning the next election.
Well, I think you're right in that it will be seen as justified. I don't know about a masterstroke if your man doesn't get up. But yes, if the Libs win the election, it will be justified by those who supported it in retrospect. I don't think that makes it justified in terms of the overall impact on the system. Yes, I can see why John Howard's taking this pragmatic view, and on Monday morning you did have Liberals round the place saying, oh, well, yeah, it was a bit of a bad week last week, but, you know, we're back and we move on, as Julia Gillard once famously said in an election where they didn't move very far. But I think, and I know this sounds a bit naive, but that is really letting the politicians get away too easily with bad behaviour. It was a bit like Michael Croghan, who was being asked about Julia Banks, the Liberal MP, who says she was bullied and is not going to contest the next election, saying, well, in leadership battles, people speak strongly to each other. There are lines here. And we all know and understand that in leadership battles, people do speak strongly. But we also know that beyond a certain point, that sort of behaviour can morph into bullying, and bullying is bad. So I do think that the Liberals who are trying to say now that last week was just a bit of a bad week and do not feel they have to explain this, should be held more to account.
Are they going to be? I was struck by a commentary you made, much to that effect, on Monday, when there seemed to be a lot of press over the weekend about the new Prime Minister, kind of a, I don't know, mini honeymoon, if you like, for a weekend about...
Well, except for that poll.
Except for that.
for a real honeymoon, you've got to have a good poll.
Yes, you're right, it didn't last too long. But there were endless stories about him being a daggy dad, and he liked meat pies, and he liked his football team, the Sharks. And
that hasn't ended very happily either.
No.
I'm not a rugby follower, but I think that there were a few bad headlines.
Yeah, the Sharks are in a mess.
It'd be interesting to see if he continues to talk about the Sharks so much.
I was struck by the Julia Banks controversy today, because it seemed like the most egregious example of what has been neatly referred to these days after leadership spills as the transactional costs. But isn't it the case that, unlike other coups, the new king doesn't have blood on his hands, and in that way is more likely to get away with it than previous new leaders who are seen to have stabbed their previous leader in the back?
Look, I think there's something in that, but the thing is that a lot of people do have blood on their hands, and there will be transaction costs. How much they get away with this depends on how great those costs are, and I think we are going to see more of those, and the Julia Banks thing was just part of that. In this case, it's going to be quite hard for the new leader to get a lot of traction. He has immense policy problems. He talks about appointing a minister for bringing down energy prices, for example, electricity prices. Well, how's that going to work? Is your bill, by the time of the election, going to be 30% lower? I mean, I would have thought if you're talking seriously about bringing down prices, ordinary people are going to want to say, well, my bill is really, really different now. And the government was on the brink of getting what seemed to be a reasonable energy policy together. Now, what is their energy policy specifically? They do say, they have this wonderful language now about carrying big sticks against companies and breaking them up and so on, but how's all that going to work? And do you need state legislation to help you carry that big stick? I suspect you do. So I think that getting momentum for the new team, which is after all mostly the old team, is going to be really difficult, and that increases the transactional costs. So, for example, if you contrast it with even when Julia Gillard was installed, which turned out to be pretty disastrous, but in the immediate days after, woman prime minister. So there was a bit of a feeling of, as Malcolm Turnbull might say, a sense of excitement, right? Even though it faded. But there's not a sense of excitement with Scott Morrison, is there?
Maybe
the meat pies are standing up all right, but the shark spin is not going to fly. It's bad territory.
One more about this particular coup and why maybe it was different. I was struck by an article by Chris Kinney, an Australian, who suggested that the Canberra Press Gallery had missed it, that it was coming, because they didn't understand effectively how toxic climate policy was inside the coalition, and that Turnbull had really pressed it too far. And essentially, at least in large part, that this coup was about policy, and that a large enough chunk of the coalition don't want a climate policy effectively, or don't want a policy that is aimed at reducing emissions. How true do you think that is, and how widespread? Is it over for climate policy on the coalition side of politics?
I suspect that, say, you have a change of government, you do have a climate policy brought in, that government has a term or two, then I think any subsequent Liberal government would accept it because it's there, it's done. It's
like the GST.
Exactly. It's a bit like the GST. Labor fought not only the 98 election but the 2001 election against the GST, wanting to roll bits back and when it was in and so on, but then that was it. And I think the same thing would happen with climate policy. But if they continued in office, I don't know, I think it would just continue to sort of fester.
I wanted to go back at something you mentioned and slightly change tack, Julia Banks controversy. For those who haven't heard, Julia Banks, the member for Chisholm, has announced that she won't recontest the election, that she's fed up with politics essentially and fed up with the bullying, and that the leadership coup was the last straw for her. And it struck me that this was, and been backed up by some senior women members of the Liberal Party and others, like Kelly O'Dwyer.
And Linda Reynolds actually gave a speech in the Senate a week ago about bullying. I don't know that she particularly focused on women, but she said she didn't recognise her party.
Struck me that this is part of a kind of wider theme going on in politics at the moment, in some sense connected to the Emma Hussar controversy, some sense connected to the Sarah Hanson-Young Lionhelm controversy. It's women speaking up and fighting back about bullying and inappropriate behaviour, and the Me Too movement, in a sense, coming to Parliament House. How are you seeing that? How's it manifesting itself? Is it a change in our politics, and is that something that needs fixing in politics?
Yes, I think this fight back is a change, and it's probably likely to grow rather than diminish. These are sort of all separate cases, so it's hard to draw the links between them, except to say that in each case the people concerned are fighting back. But I think that what the parties and the power brokers are perhaps not accepting or understanding is, as you say, that the Me Too movement has got through the doors of Parliament, and really they can't ignore it. So when people attack them, they're sort of a bit surprised and say, well, don't you realise it's always been like this? Circumstances have changed, and I think they will need to realise that it's no longer like that, acceptably.
One of the other themes, I think, running in politics at the moment, we've got the coup culture, we've got the Me Too movement coming to Parliament House. One of the other themes that seems to be subject of greater scrutiny is the role of the media itself in politics, and whether that's different. Do you think the media overall is playing a different role, or has it ever been thus? I mean, Rupert Murdoch has been well known through decades for making and breaking governments, and some people have posited that, that he has less power than he used to. We've seen tabloids, for example, run strident campaigns against the state governments in Victoria and Queensland and come up short recently. Some suggested this is a sign of the New Zealander tabloid's waning power. And on the other hand, we're hearing from some, Chris Yuman at Nine and others, suggesting that in this leadership coup in particular, sections of the media across the line effectively either brought down or significantly contributed to the fall of the Prime Minister.
Well, on the tabloids, I do think that circulation has come off, and I think probably fewer people are taking as much notice as they used to of particular papers. So I think that just on that level, their direct influence has faded somewhat. But on the media generally, there's no doubt that the media had a very significant role in this coup. And what you had was the shock jocks in Sydney, Ray Hadley, Alan Jones. You had the Sky opinion people, so-called Sky After Dark people, very, very strongly, all those people, very strongly against Turnbull and denouncing Turnbull. And people say, well, Sky doesn't have a very big audience, but the thing is it has a big audience in Parliament House, and Hadley and Jones, of course, have huge audiences, and Sky, incidentally, is about to have a much bigger audience too, going free-to-air in regional areas of New South Wales, I think, Queensland.
Canberra
too. So you had that, plus the 24-hour media cycle, which has, as I mentioned before, given exposure to a whole lot of people who wouldn't have got as much exposure before. And this includes the parties on the right, Pauline Hanson, David Lionholm's party, people like this. Now, I'm not saying they wouldn't have got coverage. Of course they would have got coverage, and I make the point that, of course, they're entitled to coverage. It is a democratic system and everyone's entitled to a voice. But they wouldn't have got as much coverage before you had this cycle where you have to have talking heads all the time. And this was a big factor in contributing to what happened last week. But I might just add one point on that. I do think that we've now got to a point where even political journalism is seen as entertainment and controversy for the sake of it. And, of course, we've got a whole class of people who actually do say they're not journalists, they're just commentators, whose whole cachet is being controversial, being out there, being extreme in their views and their presentation. The rise of that group is something of a new element.
Michelle, I'm going to ask for your reflections upon Malcolm Turnbull and how you think 29th Prime Minister is going to be remembered.
It's obviously too soon to say how he'll be remembered, to be honest. I think that he was a disappointment because so much more was expected of him. He did have to, or he did choose to, I should say, sell out quite a lot of his principles and positions in order to win the leadership, and then more of them when he got the leadership to try and hold off his enemies, which, of course, in the end, he couldn't do. I think, in a way, his political heart was in the right place, but we were talking about transactions before. He's a very transactional politician. And even if you remember the way he approached Trump, we're both businessmen. Malcolm probably would not have won the coming election, but one would think he must be not only devastated by what's happened, but disappointed, perhaps, that he hadn't used his early authority more effectively. He was much better at grasping power than using power to advantage.
Questions? I've got one here. How do you start with?
Thank you. Thanks, Michelle, for coming this evening. My name is Sue Bigley. I am a taxpayer and a Green supporter. I was wondering whether you think it's time for there to be a split in the Liberal Party and maybe the Conservatives should move further tonight.
I don't think, if you're looking at it from the Liberal Party's point of view or even the system's point of view, I don't think that a split is necessarily the most advantageous way to go. I think that somehow the Liberals need to get more people who are centrist people, more people who are moderate people, in to really contest the battle of ideas within the party. There are some moderates, but they're like church mice. I mean, they're just very quiet in terms of these ideological arguments. Well, I should perhaps except Christopher Pyne, not that he's not that he was prosecuting these cases particularly, but you couldn't say he was quiet. But you get my point, that the moderates have shrunk in numbers over the past few years. There's no doubt about that. But the moderates that are there are pretty ineffective. So I think a better route for the party would be to get a more representative group of parliamentarians to fight back.
In the last few years, we've seen a fracturing of the right, especially at a federal level, into a lot of several micro parties and independents. I was wondering if you could speak to what's causing this, why it's happening more on the right than the left, and whether it's a good thing for the parties and whether it's a good thing for the country.
Well, it's actually not happening more on the right than the left if you think that the Greens are on the left of Labor. So that's a big, quite a big block. But I think what this represents is people's alienation from the system, and some people express economic and social frustration through support of those parties, which are often personality parties, incidentally. So we had the Palmer Party, and then we've had Pauline Hanson's party at various times, various iterations, the Xenophon Party, although not, as I say, on the radical right, but the Xenophon Party, again, another party around a person. So it's as though the disillusioned people are sort of seeing, oh, that person's somehow different. He or she is outside the system, and they're attracted to those people.
just going to sneak a question in here while we're near the Senate, Michelle, and ask you your views about the Senate, because I'm struck there by the fact that sometimes we have seen some commentators blame the Senate for the current problems in politics. You know, the government hasn't been able to get its way in the Senate, and that's led to a dissolution. But I often think the Senate saves the government as much as it hurts the government. And now here's a kind of a new thought that the Senate's an outlet for people's frustration with politics sometimes, and they sometimes get a representative they might prefer. What role do you think the Senate's playing in politics today in a way different from the past, or much the same?
Well, it depends, of course, how the numbers are falling in the Senate as to what role it plays. When Labor was in power, the Senate did frustrate a couple of really important things. It frustrated the emissions trading scheme in the early stages, and it frustrated the Malaysia solution. But apart from that, Labor got most of its things, green support. Obviously, the Abbott government had terrible trouble with the Senate, and your argument comes in here about, well, we were saved from some pretty draconian measures. On the other hand, the new government that had come in could not get its way. And this takes us back to the familiar arguments about mandates, who has a mandate. Well, everyone in the Senate now thinks they've got a mandate, you know, even if they've just managed to get there through someone else's citizenship problem. So, and you sort of think, well, how does all that work? There are no absolute answers. It depends where you sit, and people here would all have different views about the extent to which small groups should frustrate governments. But it is as it is, as they say.
One bit of commentary I struck really last week, thinking that the Senate has done the responsible thing by the budget and saved the budget a lot of revenue, and lowered people's energy bills effectively by keeping the clean energy supplement, too big announcement from the government, or lost in the news last week. The Senate probably playing a slightly different role than it had in the past. Anyway, I've got a question at the back.
Do you think it's feasible or possible in the medium to long term that as people become more disillusioned with the neoliberal model and globalisation, that we might embrace a strongman model of politics, like in Russia, China, Egypt, Venezuela, Philippines? Is that too far-fetched?
Hopefully it's too far-fetched. Hopefully. Because it is a very, you know, it is a serious question. Systems can go from good to very threatening quite quickly, as we've seen in history. We do have one stabiliser, though, in our system, which is a very important one, and that's compulsory voting. Because that does force the system to the centre. And it means that you can get all the loud voices, but when it comes to an election, those who don't have loud voices go into the ballot boxes and say, well, let's be pragmatic about this. Let's ignore the extremes. Most voters do operate within more normal and sensible bounds. So I think that is our protection, but I think that it is important to remember that a democratic system, although we have a strong democratic system, it can be eroded if people don't realise that it requires constant work and tolerance and people with good values operating in it. I think what you're saying won't come to pass, but let's be watchful.
I take it for granted, yeah.
Yes, and I think unless we talk about people power, but unless people tell their MPs when they're not happy with them, the message doesn't get through. They don't have much emotional intelligence, it seems.
Got a young man just here.
If you could change their system of parliaments, how would you change it to improve the current situations? and problems with the government?
Look, I don't think there's one magic answer to this. You might... the government, for example, a couple of years ago changed the Senate voting system, sort of tweaked the Senate voting system in a way to mean that people didn't get elected on essentially bugger all votes. Then Malcolm Turnbull had a double dissolution, and so that didn't work that time. Maybe it'll work further on. But I don't think that there is just some change you can bring to the system that solves the problem, because I think that it is a question of how people use the system, its attitudes, its conventions, all those things that are important to have things functioning better. So parties always do have factions, but you get the impression at the moment that the factional system has reached such a level that it's very dysfunctional for individual parties and for the system. At other times, for example, if you go back again to the 80s, certainly the factions in the Labor Party in Canberra, while they were quite tough players, were quite functional for the Labor government. At the moment in the Liberal Party, you're seeing the factional system act in a very destructive way, I think. So that's a long way around saying there's really no simple answer to the things that are wrong with our political system.
Well, that's a good note to finish it on. Please thank Michelle Brent for coming on tonight.
Thank you.
That's been episode 27 of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute and recorded live at Politics in the Pub in Canberra on the 29th of August 2018. The book, Knowledge Solution, Politics, is published by Melbourne University Press and available online or at any good local bookshop. You can find previous episodes of Follow the Money on our website at tai.org.au/podcasts. Or listen free to Follow the Money on your favourite podcast app. We're also on Twitter at The Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Michelle Grattan is at Michelle Grattan. Grattan is with a double T, A-N. And Ben Oquist is at Ben Oquist, O-Q-U-I-S-T. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy with additional editing by Renee Sant. Our theme music is by Jonathan McPheat from Pulse and Thrum, and you can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Thanks for listening.